Hi, and welcome back to the Histories Inc. podcast. I'm Mallory Nye, and this is episode 13. This episode is going to be a discussion of the context of a particular quite short book written by King James VI of Scotland and the First of England about what he called the counterblast to tobacco, this newly discovered product from the New World, from the Americas, at the time of upheaval during the reformations that pulled apart and reformed the countries of England and Scotland that he ruled over for the first time as the joint monarch. As this new country or these new countries went into a joint project or went into their respective projects of colonialism and development of these new worlds. So, before I say anything about King James and the Counterblast to Tobacco booklet, I want to give as some introduction a particular story. A tradition goes that at some time in 1493, after returning on the ship La Niña with Christopher Columbus from the Caribbean, a sailor named Rodrigo de Jerez indulged in his new habit of tobacco smoking in his hometown of Ayamonte in southwestern Spain. He was probably not the only explorer to find a taste for smoking the dried leaves, but the reaction that he caused back at home was memorable. When Jerez lit up his pipe and smoked this new leaf in the Ayamonte streets, his neighbours didn't know what to make of it. Eventually, they reported him to the dreaded religious police, that is, the Spanish Inquisition, who were rightly feared. As one would expect, the Inquisition didn't take such strange smoking behaviour lightly, and they considered it to be some devilish practice that Jerez had picked up during his time with the pagans of the New World. His punishment was imprisonment for several years, either 3 or 7 years, according to various accounts. And so began the uneasy European encounter with tobacco. Now, fast forward 100 years, and in the early 1600s, the smoking of tobacco was still a relative innovation in England, although by the beginning of the 17th century, it had spread through many parts of society. The extent of this is very clearly shown in the decision by the recently crowned King James I of England to write a tract which he titled A Counterblast to Tobacco, which he intended as strong propaganda against what he called this vile custom, i.e. vile habit. It was initially published anonymously in 1604, but was clearly authored by the king and was reprinted under his name a few years later. James's document is unusual and distinctive in two ways. Firstly, it is a very early published criticism of the use of tobacco. And second, it was written by a reigning monarch, that is, King James VI of Scotland and the First of England. It's not the earliest printed denouncement of tobacco, and nor is it King James's only publication, but it's still worth a quick read in itself. When the book was published in 1604, James had been on the throne of England for just 1 year. The world was in considerable flux. He had himself moved from Scotland, where he'd already been king as James VI for 20 years. The opportunities of the New World across the Atlantic had been developed for over a century by the Spanish, whilst the English were only really getting started on staking their own claims to particular places there. A generation or more before, the Protestant Reformations had shaken the religious and cultural establishments of most of the northern European countries. The effects of these Reformation revolutions were still being felt. And so, within a short time of King James becoming king of both England and Scotland, he found a country in which tobacco had quickly become a popular English pastime, and was most likely popular in Scotland too. The first European experiences of tobacco smoking were by the Spanish explorers in the West Indies, when they found the native Taino Indians commonly practicing this habit of smoking. Within days of making contact back in 1492, Columbus observed in his journal that the people brought fragrant dried leaves to trade with the Spaniards. And just a few weeks later, on Tuesday the 6th of November 1492, Columbus's journal records that during an exploration of the northern coast of Cuba, he said, "The two Christians met with many people on the road going home, men and women, with a half-burnt weed in their hands, being the herbs they are accustomed to smoke. Slightly later, the friar Ramon Payne accompanied Columbus on his second voyage in 1493, and Columbus asked him to write an account of his observations during the expedition. Payne observed some Taino on the island of Hispaniola making the dry tobacco leaves into a powder, which they called cojoba. Thus, he said, the cojoba is a certain powder which they take sometimes to purge themselves, and for other effects which you will hear of later. They take it with a cane about a foot long, and put one end in the nose and the other in the powder, and in this manner they draw it into themselves through the nose, and this purges them thoroughly. The explorer Amerigo Vespucci, who also travelled several times to the New World that came to bear his name, recorded the following observations in 1499 on Margarita Island, off the coast of Venezuela. He found that the people there had their mouths full of the leaves of a green herb, which they continually chewed like beasts, so that they could hardly speak, and each had round his neck two dried gourds, one full of that herb which they had in their mouths, and the other of white flour that appeared to be powdered lime. From time to time they put in the powder with a spindle, which they kept wet in the mouth. Then they put stuff into their mouths from both, powdering the herb already in use. They did this with much elaboration, and the thing seemed wonderful, for we couldn't understand the secret, or with what object they did it. This new and unusual habit clearly held a fascination for the colonialists. It was soon taken up by the explorers, particularly the sailors of the ships that went back and forward across the Atlantic to this new world. And it is those sailors who most likely contributed to the spread in Europe of the use of the dried leaves. As illustrated in the earlier story of Rodrigo de Jerez's imprisonment by the Spanish Inquisition, the beginnings of tobacco smoking in Europe were not straightforward. Despite its novelty and potential dangers, the Spaniards weren't slow in taking up the habit, which soon caught on in the early 16th century. By 1565, a Spanish philosopher, Nicolás Munades, had taken up the practice and was promoting what he believed to be the many health benefits that could come from smoking. In his book on the plants of the West Indies, Munades made claims for tobacco curing ailments, ranging from tapeworms, kidney stones, shortness of breath, and dandruff. A French ambassador named Jean Nicot discovered the leaves when he was sent on a mission to Portugal in 1559. He found a taste for it himself and introduced it to the French queen mother back home, Catherine de Medici. She apparently found the tobacco a useful treatment for her frequent migraines, although some accounts say it was for her son, the Dauphin's migraines, and so named the plant in honour of the man who brought it to her. Hence it gained its French name of Nicotiana, which of course gave us the term nicotine. It is often assumed that it was Sir Walter Raleigh who introduced tobacco to England following his travels to the New World in the 1580s. For example, I recall the classic Bob Newhart Walter Raleigh comic sketch on this. However, tobacco had been around in England for a while before this, and the person most likely to take the credit was John Hawkins, an explorer, pirate, and slave trader who came back with tobacco from a visit to the West Indies in 1568, a number of years before Raleigh's rise to fame. Thus, Hawkins himself described, "The Floridans, when they travel, have a kind of dried herb, which, with a cane and an earthen cup in the end, with fire and the dried herbs put together, do suck through the cane the smoke thereof, which smoke satisfies their hunger, and therewith they live 4 or 5 days without meat or drink, and this all the Frenchmen used for this purpose. Yet they do hold opinion withal that it causeth water and flame to void from their stomachs." Even so, a few years later, Walter Raleigh was certainly a strong advocate of the new habit, and a shameless promoter of the leaf for his own political and financial interests. Tobacco helped to make his reputation, whilst also its popularity was greatly enhanced by his endorsement. He was the original Marlborough man. Most notable, perhaps, is the tale of the end of his life in 1618, when he calmly smoked his pipe in the hours waiting at the Tower of London for his execution. Into this we can now insert the figure of King James VI and I. It's clear from his writing that King James was not convinced by the propagandist for tobacco. He had no fondness for Raleigh, and it was he who eventually executed Raleigh after putting him under house arrest in the Tower for 13 years. However, James's antipathy for the Leaves was not solely focused on its association with Raleigh. From the Counterblast Tract, we learn that James didn't like the smell of the smoke, and he believed that it had the power to cause considerable harm, like the soot in a kitchen. He even points to an early autopsy of a heavy smoker with blackened lungs. This was not the first anti-tobacco publication, not even in English. Only 2 years before James's writing, an anonymous surgeon, calling himself Filarates, had published a tract called Work for Chimney Sweepers, or a Warning for Tobacconists, in which he put forward his considered medical arguments against the Leaves' supposed health benefits. Needless to say, his use of the term tobacconists was not to focus specifically on the sellers of tobacco, as we now understand it, but more generally to refer to all smokers, people who took the smoke rather than sold it, as tobacconists. What James brought to the table in his writing, though, was his title and position as King of England and Scotland. His writing was as much political as it was medical. Indeed, we can probably surmise that his reasons for writing such a counterblast were driven by political concerns rather than simply as due to concerns about individual health or moral dangers of tobacco. His discussion mixes up the two. The problem for the smoker is also the problem for the country. The two are interwoven. Much of James's critique of the claims made for tobacco appear to us now as outdated, as they were based on medical knowledge of the time. In fact, James did well to show his knowledge of contemporary medicine as then was, since after all he was trained as a monarch rather than as a physician. Even so, there are still modern resonances in James's arguments that make them worth receiving a new airing. Despite his clear displeasure at smoking and his wish to see the habit of tobacco smoking ceased, it is interesting that James didn't in fact go so far as to outlaw it. It may possibly be that he would have provoked too much of a backlash against the nobility in England. After all, he had seen in Scotland the vulnerability of a monarch who didn't have the support needed from the lords. His mother had been deposed in his favour in such a situation, and he had himself been subject to scheming lords, such as the Earls of Gowrie, who had at one point tried to kill him. By the time of the writing of his tract, tobacco had apparently become too firmly embedded in English popular culture, as he does himself allude to in his writing. Indeed, if this were not the case, then why would a king choose to change his subjects' habits through lecturing them? If he could make the positive change that he wished for, either through criminalizing the substance or levying a preventative tax on it, then he would most likely have done so. In fact, he did. He substantially raised the tax on tobacco in 1605 from 2 pence per pound to 82 pence per pound, that is, 6 shillings and 10 pence, an increase of over 4,000%. That is, in today's money, the tax was approximately £35 or $50 per pound, or £78 per kilogram. It's interesting to note here that the current UK tariff on other smoking rolling tobacco is just under £104 per kilogram, so even higher than James's rate if we make the conversion. As history shows us, King James's substantial tax increase was not particularly successful. After all, the spread of tobacco through English culture and far beyond was not prevented. Quite interestingly, one of James's challenges with tobacco was not so much his repulsion to the stink of the smoke or to the harm it would cause to his subjects' bodies. It was more about practical issues of international trade. The main source of tobacco at that time was the West Indies, under the control of the Spanish colonialists. They had a monopoly on the commodity and were therefore able to significantly profit from the weakness of the English and the Scots and the Welsh for the dried leaves. In fact, that was along with much of the rest of the continent. There was nothing that could be done for England to avoid this monopoly, since there were no viable alternative sources of tobacco in 1604 at the time of James's publication. However, things changed significantly during the time of James's monarchy. Up until the early 1600s, the English attempts to establish colonies in America, particularly along the North Atlantic seaboard above Florida, had proved largely ineffectual. The most obvious example of this was Walter Raleigh's disastrous settlements on Roanoke Island off Virginia, which had left the poor colonists destroyed by freezing winters, conflicts with the native people, and starvation. The settlement at Jamestown, bearing King James's name, that was established in 1607, looked likely to go the same way. Despite all the success that the Spanish had had in the central regions of America, either plundering gold or otherwise developing cash crops such as tobacco, the more northern areas of the new continent were not proving so amenable to the English. The greatest successes the English seafarers had up to the time of King James was through slave trading, or otherwise piracy and seizure of Spanish treasures, rather than through the establishment of new colonies and trade. A significant turning point, however, came in 1614, when John Rolfe, the man who went down in history as marrying the native chief's daughter Pocahontas, finally succeeded to cultivate a strain of the tobacco plant in Virginia, which he'd managed to smuggle out of the Spanish West Indies. Once established, this became a major export from the Virginia colony to England. This meant that the English were finally able to develop their own cash crop, which proved extremely lucrative over the years. It became their brown gold, and of course meant that the English at last had control over the production of the commodity that had such a considerable home consumption. There were no more lost revenues to the Spanish, which made James happy, despite his concerns about the nature of tobacco itself. What happened in Jamestown over this issue was in many respects a forerunner of the pattern of English colonialism in North America. James decided to impose harsh trade terms to the Virginia tobacco growers, setting their selling price at an extremely low level, whilst also requiring them to fund the cost of shipment back to England. He also bound them to trade exclusively with Britain and no other partner, thus cutting them off from making better money by trading more on their own terms. It was the first tax imposed on the English New World settlers, and quite naturally it encouraged resentment. James was himself wary of this, since he viewed his relationship as monarch with the settlers as being no different from any of his other subjects, whether they be in Scotland or northern or southern England. The settlers had a rather different view. The width of the Atlantic and the difficulties of passage and communication with London meant that they felt at a further remove, and thus more free of state control. All this helped to establish patterns of perspective that eventually took shape a century and a half later with American independence, launched on the basis of the idea of no taxation of Americans without representation in British politics. In short, tobacco was one of the first things that concerned James on his taking over as King of England, and despite his clear misgivings about the substance, it was tobacco that would eventually be the source of significant British colonialism in America. This is reason in itself for us to look again at James's own writings on the matter, even though he didn't address the wider geopolitical issues in this work. One thing that James did address, however, was one of the most obvious elements of tobacco to him. That is, it was a foreign custom that had been adopted by the English from the native people of America. James's own views on the Indians are made very clear in his tract. He had very little respect for them, and considered the people of Europe, and in particular the English and Scottish, as being of a much more refined status, or at least the nobles. He equates the Indians with the syphilis pox that the European colonialists also brought back from the Caribbean. The one was apparently the corollary of the other. However, like much else that came about from European expansion into and colonization of America, it was the interaction with the native people that was most significant, whether that be through trade, conquest, or rape. In the case of the Spanish, much of this proceeded simply in the wake of the colonialists' swords. They came, they saw, and they took what they wanted, killing those who were in their way. Alongside this, there was a minor key agenda for the saving of the souls of the Native Americans. This was a chance for them to learn of Jesus and thus to become faithful Christians, members of the Catholic Church that was itself going through considerable turmoil in Europe during those times. Although Christianity had already spread beyond the bounds of European Christendom in the previous millennium, to places such as India and Ethiopia. This was one of the first times that European Christianity in the form of Catholicism was implanted onto another continent. It happened in parallel with the Portuguese colonization projects in the Indian Ocean, down the coast of India and across to the Spice Islands and eventually to Macau on the China coast. Likewise, the Spanish finally met them coming the other way when they colonized the Philippines. Christianity at this point was truly going global. In return for this, and for all the other gifts, such as the pandemic diseases unwittingly passed from the Europeans to the Native Americans, the Europeans received in particular this love of tobacco smoking, a custom of many of the natives of the Caribbean and the newfound continent. Within a short time, much of Europe had become hardened smokers, along with people in places much further afield. Just as the eastern spices were taken by trade routes across from the East Indies, southern Indonesia, to all corners of Europe, the Spanish and later British trade in tobacco brought the crop first to Europe and then across much of mainland Asia, including the Arab world, Persia, and then China and Japan. And so, boom, the habits of the world changed within just a few generations. In itself, this helped to give us the enduring stereotype of the so-called Oriental man with his hookah, the hubble-bubble from which he took his scented tobacco, that came about through European trade with the eastern Mediterranean and then via the Portuguese within the Indian Ocean. One further outcome of this was, of course, the growing European need for a source of low-cost labour to produce, harvest and process the crops. Initially tobacco, and then soon after other New World crops, some taken there by the Europeans, such as sugar and cotton. At first, this labour was recruited opportunistically, such as sending out indentured workers from the corners of their own countries, such as the British use of Irish and in some cases Scottish workers, or otherwise by the enslavement of the local indigenous Americans. The moral voices of the Europeans, most notably Bartolomé de las Casas in Spain, spoke against this, leading to the famous Spanish debate in Valladolid in 1550-51 on the Christian and hence imperial Spanish morality of natural enslavement. It was notable also that a legal case in Virginia in 1640 established the legality of slavery in the first English colony. This was the case of John Punch, an African who had attempted to run away from his place of work. As with James in his moral counterblast against tobacco, the economic realities that favoured slavery won out over the moral debates. The colonization and exploitation of America required such a scale of land use, of industry, of production, that the easy option for countries such as Portugal, Spain, France, and Britain was eventually to develop a system of seizure of Africans from the West Coast, transportation across the Atlantic, to be sold as slaves in the market of the Caribbean and the Atlantic seaboard. This transatlantic trade was already in place in 1604, when King James wrote his counterblast. The English sailor John Hawkins had profited from this trade back in the 1560s, and by this time the Spanish were regularly shipping slaves from Africa to their colonies in New Spain. And for a further 2 centuries, this was a socially acceptable, indeed vital, economic system. We need to bear much of this in mind as we read James's account of tobacco, since it is the underlying subtext that is not clearly visible in his actual words. Much of what he says now seems irrelevant, inaccurate, or disappointing about a subject that has exercised medical and moral concerns across the world for more than 4 centuries. It's testimony to the human condition that a substance that was recognized so long ago as being capable of so much harm has continued to be used and abused largely unabated. The recent legislation against public smoking and to increase public health education, such as mandatory package warnings stating the obvious that smoking kills, seem like a drop in the ocean across the expanse of 400 years. And yet at the same time, King James's complaint about having to breathe in others' tobacco smoke whilst dining rings true as much today as is in his own time. This is the importance of James's work. It is at the cusp of so many currents of history, and this book is a record that comes to us from one of the makers of that history. On one level, it's merely a curiosity, whilst on another, it's a small window into how our world came about. Contained within it are issues of the fundamental encounter with the indigenous people of the New World, the health risks of smoking, the social consequences of the habit, together with the unfolding history from the encounter between the Old and New Worlds, including slavery, genocide, economic appropriation of the resources of the American continent, and the rise of British settlers' desires for independence from the mother country. Such a history is ongoing in so many ways. So, thanks for listening today. And if you want to find out more, you can go onto the histories-inc.com website, where you get the show notes. There's also a link to the short book, an updated version of King James's Counterblast to Tobacco, which you can download to read, and further details about some of the issues that I discuss in this episode today. If you're also interested, I also produce a second podcast, Religion Bites, which can be found on religionbites.xyz on the website, which is broadly an introduction to the study of religion from a contemporary perspective, the study of religion and culture, or religious studies. I hope you enjoy listening to that as well. So that's all for today, and I'll see you again in the next episode. Bye for now.